Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rantz. We've recorded this edition of our weekly podcast from Farm Forum event in Saskatoon, so I'll be joined throughout the show by my colleagues from Glacier Farm Media. For those of you who couldn't attend, Farm Forum event is a three-day learning event hosted by Glacier Farm Media. We've moved the event back to its roots in Saskatoon this year, after 3 years in Calgary. You know, in agriculture, we talk almost daily about the concept of precision, and it's hard sometimes to even understand exactly what that is. Several speakers at this year's Farm Forum event talked about what it isn't. One of those speakers was Corey Wilness, the president of Croptimistic Technology Incorporated, who spoke to Glacier Farm Media's Spencer Myers. Corey said that while there are a lot of great tools available today, there are also some myths that need addressing. Here's what they talked about.
And you just gave a talk to some farmers, some producers, about 10 myths surrounding the precision ag sector, I guess you want to call it. And your first point is kind of hitting the nail right on the head, that precision ag isn't precision farming. So I'd like you to kind of go into depth about that first point and kind of just break down what you mean by saying precision ag isn't just precision farming.
Well, I guess probably what needs to be understood is that, you know, it's a process. So most people, they want to think of it in terms of you're going from sort of a base level of what they do today, then they adopt precision, and they think it's going to be a really big step when it's actually an incremental process, and each step is maybe just getting slightly better than the next step. And so it's not like you're hitting the bullseye with everything you do. You're just trying to incrementally get closer to the center, and you know, it's a bit of a learning process, not something that usually out of the gate really nails things the first time.
Yeah, and I think part of the what you mentioned as well is that in order to even start to get into precision ag, you kind of have to have good management, you kind of have to have good practices. So do you want to just touch on that really quick?
Yeah, I would say it's really important to do first things first. In other words, make sure you're managing your insects, weeds, diseases, have a good fertility program, you're doing a good job of seeding and spraying, timely operations. You know, those are the key things for profitability. And then precision ag, precision farming can be the next step above that.
But
to help you do you know, site-specific things once you've dealt with those.
But it all comes out of having those good management practices from the start, like you said, having basically doing the basics, right?
Correct.
Another really interesting thing I noticed about your presentation is that right near the beginning of the presentation, you stressed that you kind of start with your end in mind. And I think to quote you here, you said, start with the end in sight. So is that applicable to kind of everything that you're talking about? Or I guess just kind of give me some more context on what you were saying there.
Yeah, I think starting with the end in sight is applicable to everything. You know, if people who maybe start by thinking, well, I should buy a precision ag software program or a certain piece of equipment, haven't really thought through is what they're intending to do with this thing, right? How is this going to make me money? What can this improve on my farm? So, you know, for variable rate fertilizer might be a good example. So it's not just buying a piece of equipment that does what you want to do, but then, well, how do you build zones or how are those soils sampled? And you don't just go out and sign up with some service, right? You have to have a picture in your mind of what you want to accomplish, and you've seen your fields and the problems in them, and maybe maturity and lodging, and some areas aren't performing, and then you know, the technology that you're going to be purchasing and utilizing has to be able to nail those areas and nail an agronomic solution that you know, can be used site specifically with it.
So in other words, you're basically saying plan, but you really need to know your end goals for a lot of these things in order to make sure you're buying the right equipment, adapting the right processes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I have a very good picture of exactly what you want to do.
Point number four in your presentation was talking about, you know, I guess I like to call this data mining just because it's applicable in a bunch of different sectors, not just agriculture. But, you know, agriculture, we are collecting a lot of data right now in a bunch of different ways. A big one you stressed today is just, you know, even just kind of telling people the difference between topography and elevation. And a lot of people, you know, if you're in the community, farming community or geology, you might know that. A lot of people might make that mistake though. In terms of collecting all this data, you stressed you know, not telling farmers or producers what data to collect, but maybe to think about why they're collecting that data. Anything to elaborate on that?
Yeah, like I think with the start and end in sight theme, is that, you know, to do certain things, let's just say it's a very borate fungicide application, you don't need, you know, to be collecting data on every piece of equipment, like as applied maps and every piece of equipment. You don't need yield maps and, you know, detailed soil tests. It's a perfect example of something where you could, you know, specifically go and get a specific satellite image of that point in time. You could go out and ground truth it, you know, decide on how you want to put zero fungicide in a certain area or different rates of fungicide. You know, so it's an example of, you know, a very specific thing that you want to do and a very specific type of data that you need to accomplish it. So I think a lot of people have been like collecting yield data for 20 years and there's lots of tools now. People are collecting things, but they still don't know why they're collecting it. And that's sort of the...
Jumping from point number four to point number five in your 10 myths to 10 myths of precision ag, you said picking a platform versus picking a process. I like your smartphone analogy that, you know, we do have a tool in our pocket that can do many different things, but there isn't one button on this device that just does everything. And I think what you kind of said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but you said farmers should avoid looking out for a do-it-all platform or a do-it-all solution in terms of precision ag. Do you want to elaborate just a little bit on that, on the difference between picking the process versus the platform?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's lots of different platforms out there. Some of them do some things really well and maybe don't do other things at all. That doesn't mean that you don't, you know, use that platform for that specific thing. This concept of I want a platform that does everything.
Yeah.
You know, you're probably choosing something that does everything and none of them really well.
Yes.
Right? So on my smartphone, I have all the apps that I like to use, right?
Yeah.
And they don't connect. Data doesn't flow between them all.
Mm-hmm.
They're all used individually. But, you know, that's where we're at with precision ag. There's new sensors coming out all the time, new technologies. I mean, you just got to use the platform that is available to do the process that you need. And
kind of using the platform as it's designed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
A good way to articulate this is different social media platforms are designed for different uses. You know, Facebook might not be the best place to sell your photography, and Instagram might not be the best place to invite people. So I could see the connection there. One last question. How do these myths help the average Canadian farm? I know that's a pretty rounded question, but if there's one general takeaway from your presentation, what would that be?
I guess just the most important thing would just be to make people use their common sense. You know, I think right now there's a lot of hype around a lot of technologies and a lot of it's unfounded. So, you know, use your common sense.
Anywhere where people can learn more about your presentation from today?
You can go to our websites at swapmaps.com or croppro.ca.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Corey.
Thank you.
That was Glacier Farm Media's Spencer Myers talking to Corey Wilness, president of Croptimistic Technology Incorporated. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rance. I had a chance to sit in on a session with Saskatchewan farmer and agronomy coach Terry Eberhardt, who was speaking about the past, present, and future for precision ag. He made some surprising predictions. Here's what he had to say when I followed up with him afterwards. You talked about the convergence, really, between biological understanding, realizing what's going on in the soil and regenerative, and they need to bring some of the new technologies into play.
Yeah.
But you also talked about the idea that we might actually be farming smaller in the future.
Absolutely.
Do you see the day where you might be actually farming fewer acres and making more money?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, up to now we've gone on this trend of, you know, big equipment, creating efficiencies because you want to spread the farmer over more acres, essentially. But now that creates a lot of inefficiencies, and very, very expensive equipment as well. So we're going to, with new technology and robotics and automation and stuff like that, well, we could have 10, 12 sprayers that are 10 feet wide or whatever it is, and it's going to allow us to farm much more precisely and do things in certain areas of the field that we couldn't do before because we were just trying to do the trend in agriculture equipment and practices, generally speaking, in broad acre crops has been bigger, 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 bigger. But I think that's totally going to get flipped on its head when we get into some of these technologies and will allow us. And that's exactly what we're looking at in general on our farm and with some of these technologies is there's a lot that we're doing that's very inefficient or actually not making money and it's not good for the environment. So let's look at what we should do that makes the most sense.
You talked about variable rate and what that's done for you in terms of profitability. Can you give me some examples of just how that's worked for you on your farm?
As far as which, sorry?
Variable rate applications versus flat rate applications.
Yeah, well, I mean, I shared some of that in the presentation, but generally speaking, you know, we just see better net results. We're using our inputs either more efficiently. So in some cases, we're saving money, depending on whether it's fertilizer, variable rate chemicals or whatnot. But we're also increasing output. So we're becoming more efficient with what we do put in. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of examples that we've seen, and other companies or people out there doing this. There's a benefit to precision ag. That's why people are doing it.
But you dialed back the precision ag concept to just doing a better job of what you were doing yesterday, as opposed to there's this thing that I think a lot of people find a little bit out there.
Yeah, well, like we started our precision ag journey, and we tried to go to the 10th degree and figure out all the variability, and it drove us crazy, and it was really stressful because you knew there's so much that you didn't understand, and so it prevented us from moving forward a lot of times, and it was also quite costly and cumbersome for growers to implement. And then we just started thinking, like, there's so much simple stuff we're missing here. Like, why are we overcomplicating it? Just look at the simplest things. Like, hey, this whole 20-acre patch is losing money. Well, don't farm it anymore. That's a form of precision agriculture, right? And we're using precision data to come to that decision. So we've really, I guess in our mindset and what we're doing, we've really kind of shifted it back to, let's look at like the very simple, like we're missing stuff that's, because we're thinking about the complexity and we're missing like the simplest things that are right in front of our nose.
How has profit mapping versus yield mapping changed how you farm?
Well, yield mapping just shows you that it's low yield. Okay, so what? Slow yield. But profit mapping shows you, hey, maybe you're actually losing money there, and you think, well, hey, do you want to go to work? Do you want to have to pay to go to work? Right? So it's like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do that. If you had a job where you had to pay to go to work, would you do it? No, you wouldn't do it. And so we're doing that on our farms in some cases. And it's simply just, so that's a difference in a profit map. It helps you understand that equation, and then you can decide, hey, maybe if I got to pay to go to work, I don't want to go to work today.
You said that you run a big fan of big data. Can you just explain that?
Well, I think I'm not a fan of the hype that people have created with big data, and
like, is it more farm specific data as opposed to?
I think it's just, you know, there's been a lot of, I shouldn't say I'm not a fan of big data. I'm a fan of big data, but I think I'm not a fan of the perception that people have of what big data was going to promise. And there's been a lot of hype and noise, but the reality is you need systems, and this is the coin that I'm using, is intelligent data. When you can take that big data and turn it into intelligent data, now it has value and it's something that people can understand. Otherwise, it's just like a bunch of ones and zeros like the Matrix or something.
What excites you most about the future?
The future. I think that we live in an incredible time. I think we have an incredible amount of abundance. I think that, you know, generally speaking, we're bombarded by negativity in the media and social media and things like that. Like, if you ask people, is the world getting better or worse? Well, most people say it's getting worse. But the facts are people are living longer every year. Less people are dying of cancer every year. There's less hungry people in the world every year. The world is getting better, and we're using technology and tools to do that. I mean, and so I'm just excited about the future and all the things that we're going to be able to do. It's also scary at the same time, and sometimes feels overwhelming. But if you kind of have that mindset of embracing it and looking at where the opportunity is, there's lots of opportunities out there, and we need everybody to find them.
Do you see what you're doing on your farm as something that contributes to climate change resilience for agriculture? I mean, do you think that there's an opportunity for agriculture in that discussion?
Absolutely. I think all the things that we're doing on the farm, generally speaking, are, you know, creating, the things that we're improving on our farm are creating something that's better for the environment and more sustainable. And sustainability has really been, you know, overused, I think. But sustainability to me means something that you can sustain over time and improve. And there's certain farming systems, like it's very ironic, and you probably don't want to go down that path, but there's certain things that people are doing that are coining sustainable, but they're actually not sustainable long term. And so, you know, you need to find systems that are improving what we do and improving the soil and improving the output. And farmers have to be profitable. If you're not profitable, you're not sustainable, because no one's funding us money to farm for fun, and nobody wants to pay to go to work. I believe a lot of these things, all of the examples I use in my presentation are things that are creating more efficiency with inputs, having less negative impact on the environment, and are creating more sustainable processes for the future.
And they're making more money.
That's right. So you need to have all those things. You need to have something that improves the process, has less negative impacts, and ideally has, you know, long-term positive impacts, and is profitable. Because if it's not profitable, no one's going to do it.
That was Terry Eberhardt of Eberhardt Farms. Joining me now is the Western Producers' Robert Arneson, who is here to talk about how to shrink your weed bank without using herbicides. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Laura. Good to be here.
Now, you took in a session with Christian Willenberg, who's a professor with the University of Saskatchewan. Tell me what you learned.
Well, it was a really interesting presentation. As you mentioned, Christian's a weed scientist at the University of Saskatchewan. And he's been studying weed seed predators for about 9 years, I guess. So these predators, that's sort of a generic term.
What's a predator for a weed?
So things like mice, birds, earthworms, and beetles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea here is that, you know, growers need to control, the amount of weed seed that goes back into the soil.
Right.
So if these critters eat the seed, then less seed goes back in the weed bank, and then that reduces the amount of weeds that emerge the next year. So
that's a fairly interesting concept. I mean, how prevalent is that?
Yeah, so what he told me is that it's actually a fairly common practice in Europe. So what the growers do over there, obviously they have smaller fields, and within those fields, they have little areas that are kind of look like shelter belts, but they call them beetle banks.
Okay.
So these beetle banks would be like a little strip of land that has natural vegetation. And within that, the beetles would live throughout the year. So it's like a year-round habitat, so that then they could go out to the field when needed to eat the weed seeds.
So you had a conversation with him after the presentation. Were you able to collect some of his thoughts around this?
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to know was, well, does this really work? You know, is it possible for a beetle or a mouse to actually make a difference?
Right.
So that was one thing I was definitely curious about. So he talked about that a little bit.
I guess as a skeptic or a cynic might say, well, you know, there's, you know, one plant can produce thousands of seeds, and there's could be many weeds on a certain quarter section or whatever. How could possibly these predators, you know, make a big difference?
Well, they can make a big difference. They'll never be the ultimate solution. And so part of it, you have to have a combination of factors. You have to have something above ground that's going to reduce the density of those seeds coming in, because you're right, the number of beetles will probably always be overwhelmed by seeds. So if you have in combination a strategy that limits density above ground but encourages seed predators, this is where we get to the points where their effects can be sort of wide-ranging across a population over time. And it will be over time. It's never a 1 or 2 year thing.
Right.
So, Robert, are there things that farmers can do to sort of enhance this process?
Yeah, so it turns out that there are steps you can take. So for example, one thing he mentioned is that, let's say you're a non-tiller, you don't use tillage, then obviously by having that stubbled around, that does provide a better habitat for beetles, mice, whatever, throughout the season so that they can survive. Another thing that's possible is cover crops. So if you have that cover between the rows, these beetles, mice, whatever, have a place to hide from their predators, and therefore the numbers of these these creatures can increase, and therefore you have more of them around to eat weed seeds. Another thing that's also possible that one grower in Saskatchewan has done is that he actually put a bunch of bales along the side of his field, and these bales provided a habitat for beetles and mice throughout the year, so that again you could have a space for these critters, whatever you want to call them, to coexist with the cropland and be available to eat weed seeds.
So what did he have to say about that?
Yeah, so I guess basically kind of what he told me is that there are tools and techniques that you can use here in Canada and Western Canada to kind of enhance your beetle and mouse population in fields, and this is what he told me.
You know, it's interesting. There are a couple growers that have contacted me that are, and we're actually part of a joint project looking
here
at growers that are doing it. Another grower contacted me, and I can't remember the exact reason, but he had actually set up rows of bales. And he wondered if these were serving as a beetle bank, and I suggested they may well be. And he had that observation because he said he has nothing but birds sitting on them, picking off rodents and insects.
And so instead of having a simple way, just have like a row
bales.
Of bales
yeah.
somewhere
created
out there
habitat.
To provide some sort of shelter
exactly.
for these
yeah,
creatures.
Exactly. And I mean, pollination strips are better with, you know, some of the impacts on native pollinators. But
there is some uptake.
There's some uptake, yeah. There's definitely some uptake. And there's big uptake in Europe, yeah.
In Europe,
yeah,
this is a big
yeah,
thing.
This is common, yeah.
It is.
Yeah, and they're, and again,
I didn't
they're,
know that. Okay.
And part of it is their fields are small and irregularly shaped, so they naturally have margins,
right.
you know, within a 50-meter distance pretty regularly.
It's not like the Red River Valley where you don't see a tree for
no.
20 kilometers.
And they're not farming, you know,
right.
two sections together, right?
Okay.
So.
Thanks, Robert. So are there other tools available to farmers then?
Yeah, you know, as you probably know, one technology that received a lot of press and attention a couple years ago was something called the Harrington Seed Destructor.
Right. Yeah.
So that's a technology that came out of Australia. Basically, it's a machine that you would tow behind a combine, and now they're actually built into some combines. And the basic idea is that it's like a mill that destroys the weed seeds, and you could kill like 95-90% of the weed seeds, and therefore you don't have that seed going back into the seed bank. So what Christian Wilberg told me, though, is that some producers sort of view this technology as a silver bullet, but as we know, there's no such thing as a silver bullet in agriculture. Some of the limitations of the Harrington Seed Destructor are that, well, in a year like 2009, by the time you get the combine out there, a lot of weeds have already shed their seeds, so you're too late. And certain types of weeds actually shed their seeds earlier in the season, so therefore, again, you're not, you know, killing them with this Harrington Seed Destructor. So therefore, the point he was trying to make in the presentation was, if there are seeds that fall to the ground, that's going to happen. And therefore, if you have these natural predators around who are there to consume the seeds, well, you might as well take advantage of that and use them to help you manage your weed seed bank.
I guess it gets me thinking. I mean, a lot of farmers don't like the idea of having mice in their fields, but this is actually a positive thing when you're trying to deal with these kinds of situations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could think of these beetles, mice, whatever other animals are eating the seeds as sort of like beneficial
insects
or rodents in this case
yeah.
that are sort of providing this assistance. So it definitely requires a shift in thinking. Obviously, you don't want to have your farmhouse infested with mice, but maybe having a few around in the field and having beetles around to help you with this service is a good thing.
So is that the main takeaway for farmers from a session like that?
Yeah, you know, I think we've all written many articles about herbicide resistance and the challenges that is causing in Western Canada for, you know, hundreds or not thousands of farmers. And a lot of people are looking for tools, techniques to find a way to, you know, deal with their weeds and the seeds from these weeds. So I think he was just trying to present the idea that this is a novel, unique approach to kind of help you as a producer deal with this problem. And I think obviously a non-herbicide solution, like these options are useful.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
That was the Western Producers, Robert Arneson. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rantz. One of this year's keynote speakers was Terry Griffin, a cropping systems economist with Kansas State University, who has conducted extensive research into how farmers can make profitable decisions around precision agriculture. Here's a conversation he had with Mike Rain of The Western Producer.
Terry, we got a lot of things to go over in a short period of time because precision ag is a lot of things. It's all about variability because otherwise every field would be the same and every farm would be the same and somehow grain buyers would find a way to take advantage of that. So, I mean, farmers want information about what's going on their farms, and I'm really curious. So back on the farm, are there some choices that farmers can make about using precision tools that are part of today's agriculture? Are there better choices they can make right out of the door today than be different choices than they were a few years ago? But are there better choices that they can make today to take advantage of data that they've been collecting or tactics or tools that are available to them on the farm?
Well, it depends on what type of precision farmer that they are. Yeah. Okay, so some farmers are more inclined to favor equipment, to machinery, and automated guidance, automated section control are pretty low-hanging fruits. Their payback periods are relatively short, depends on field geometry. In the western provinces of Canada, large field sizes, huge. So that favors automated guidance, making a lot of parallel passes. In some areas with smaller fields that are organically shaped, you know, they've got creeks on. You've seen these.
They're following the contours of the land and what's available to you, and making the best use of it, though.
You know, in those fields, automated section control has a relative advantage because you got a lot of triangles, a lot of corner rows that you're trying to not double plant, not double spray.
So, not double fertilize. You can start to pay for automation and guidance.
And we measure the payback period not in years, but in weeks, usually. Yeah. So, I mean, the technical term is a no-brainer, you know, decision on those.
So guidance being the first thing that everybody can take advantage of, and every tractor comes with it today, every sprayer.
It's kind of hard to get it without it.
Yeah, I'd like that with the foam marker, please. no, that, you know, that's probably not, although some... There is some planting equipment that still comes with the wing markers and disc markers on them, but
with the 48-row planter, that'd be a really heavy, expensive set of markers. It'd be more expensive than the guidance system.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, you want to buy a good welder with that too. I think there might be some tear off involved. No, but so everybody has it, and I guess at harvest time we get down to the idea that my combine has a yield monitor in it. That's and I have two or three combines, and they're all the same. It might even be the same year, same brand, of course. Right. Easy to service, easy to train people to run, and of course every yield monitor is going to be exactly the same.
No. We've seen this time and time again where they have multiple combines in the same field. You can see which ones by looking at the map. You know, we've talked about analyzing yield monitor data. And when we have multiple combines in the same field, we can easily see where each of them are. But I'll take it a step further. You can use the same combine harvester, but two different operators throughout the day, and you can see differences. You know, there's some slight differences in ground speed or the way that they operate that can be detected by looking at yield monitor data.
What radio station they're listening to.
What eye color. Yeah, there's lots of things that we can take a look at.
But I mean, if you calibrate them, they're all going to be the same once you and if you calibrate say for you're on wheat, so you calibrate for wheat, and even if it was one machine, is that good enough?
Calibration is necessary for us to have any assurance of data quality, but it does not ensure quality data.
Yeah.
And even the best circumstances, about a third of the yield monitor data points will be measured. The yield monitor would not be able to make an accurate measurement because of speeding up, slowing down, too fast or too slow. We're trying to keep a constant amount of grain coming into the throat of the combine to make accurate measurements. And if we deviate from that, then even with an accurately calibrated monitor, we're unable to make good measurements.
So clean data, good data is what it's all, I mean, what we're talking about is having the best quality data you can get, but maybe not putting all your all the stock in that alone.
What are we going to do with the data? So I think one of the greatest returns on the investment of ag tech, digital agriculture farm data, the yield monitor, is conducting your own on-farm experiments. And in those cases, we want to have the best data quality we can get, because if we do not clean the data correctly, there's a good chance that the farm management decisions we'd make from that analysis would be different or lead us down the wrong path for next year. So data quality is important, and if we're, it depends on how we're going to use it. If I'm doing production agriculture in a day-to-day fashion, you know, the quality of that yield monitor data would be different than if I'm trying to decide which fungicides to apply next year, trying to get that localized information for my farm and or my management style.
So deciding what you want the data to tell you is important, because it may not be the same. The same results may not be used to tell you the same message.
Right. And so in economics 101, we talk about it depends is the answer usually to most any question.
Yeah.
And it does. It depends on what our intent of using that data is for.
Okay. Now, as producers look at data, a lot of us have been collecting it for some time, mm-hmm. some more than others. Some people haven't decided what to do with it. They treat it like it's old photos. You're not sure you want to throw them away because they might be useful someday. Or farm equipment, in my case, don't trade it. I'll keep the old stuff. Might need it someday.
Might.
But that data at some point, if you go to use it, or even with your current data, is there anything you can do to clean it up? Because there's lots of software sellers that will tell you there's my system will clean up your data for you and give you a better representation and make a prettier picture, but is there anything I can do with the data myself?
There is. One is we should always keep a copy of the original data. If it does get cleaned by a sophisticated process today, well, we may learn something in the future that we didn't know today and we did it wrong.
Right? Yeah.
So we should always, standard operating procedures, we should always keep a copy of the raw data. I would like to think that most farm data software providers do that, but I cannot promise that that happens. There's a lot of data collecting digital dust on hard drives and desk drawers. You know, mm-hmm. we pull the hard drives out of old computers. We have data going back to the 1990s. There is a time decay function. You know, mm-hmm. data from this season is more valuable than last year.
Yeah.
In particular, if we're talking about hybrids that have a shelf life of maybe 3 years. So there is a time decay function, but I would argue that data, no matter how old, still has value, and we should not discard it because of age or if we just decide we're tired of keeping the hard drives in a desk drawer.
If I keep it as a, say, if I print it off the computer, I make mm-hmm. myself a pretty map,
yeah,
and
pretty map.
Got something to look at, and I save those in binders, which I
or wallpaper.
Wallpaper's nice. Yeah. Any other good uses for printed yield maps? And
if we think really hard, I bet we can come up with something. A lot of farms will have absentee landowners, mm-hmm. and a lot of absentee landowners have emotional attachment to the farm. There is a competition among farmers to attract landowners.
There is some of that going on. Yeah, I've seen that happen, yeah.
And printing yield maps on placemats or coffee mugs for Christmas presents to retain.
Very useful in retaining a landlord.
Attracting a new landowner.
Yeah, no, that seems to make sense.
There are valuable farm management uses of printed yield maps.
Okay. Thanks, Terry. I appreciate this. I'm going to go home and see what I can. If maybe on a Yeti mug or something, maybe I can find a good use good use for printing out some yield map information and make better use of it on my farm.
I'd like to see those when you'd make that.
Thank you very much.
That was Mike Rain speaking with Terry Griffin, one of the keynote speakers at this year's Farm Forum event. And now for a weekly look at the markets. I'm joined by Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Market Information for Glacier Farm Media. And now for our weekly look at the markets. I'm joined by Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Market Information for Glacier Farm Media. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Now, I think as we sort of, we're pretty much done with harvest for 2019, although harvest isn't done. What's the hangover for farmers going into 2020 from the year that we've just had?
Well, certainly it's going to take all winter for them to recover just their mental health almost from the conditions that we had this fall and actually even back into the summertime. But the obvious hangover right now is the unharvested area.
Do we know how much that is?
No, I estimate about 5.5 million tons left out in the field.
Wow.
Which is a significant amount when you think about it.
But and it's spread across the prairies too. It's not just in one pocket, really.
Yeah, in the past we've always said things like, oh, in northeastern Saskatchewan it's been too wet, we can't harvest, which is not what's happened this year, but or northern Alberta. And northern Alberta, I think, is probably the area right now that, quite frankly, they've had 3 or 4 years out of the last 5 that really have been tough harvests and they've had to leave crops out. But this year the problem has been that it is extended from Manitoba all the way through Saskatchewan and into Alberta. So we have a much larger area than we usually would have, and it's not just a pocket, it's just a generally large area. So you know, good weather in a specific location this spring is not going to solve it. We're going to need nice weather this spring to get that harvest off. But that's going to put us up against the eight ball for planting next year. A lot of the fall field work.
Not much fertilizer went down.
No, exactly. And the other thing that I think I'm really worried about is that the eastern prairies, especially east of, let's say, Regina into Manitoba, has been extremely wet. And that means that we're going to have some type of flooding issues in the river basins, the Assiniboine, the Souris, the Red River, obviously, this spring, whether we like it or not, because any ounce of precipitation that we get over the wintertime is going to have to flow into the river system because the soils are saturated. So that, again, is something that we're going to have to deal with. Certainly, if we had an ideal spring conditions like we had, you know, last year was extremely dry, that would be good.
yeah, we're actually looking for a dry spring.
Yeah, we'd be looking for a dry spring. But you say that, farmers in southwestern Saskatchewan and southern Alberta don't want that dry spring because the soils are still dry there.
So what are the long-term forecasts looking for as far as the winter? I mean, are we going to be getting a lot of snow, or is there any indication of how that's going to shake out?
Well, if you include November as a winter month rather than a harvest month, we've already seen that above normal precipitation this winter, which is one of the forecasts, kick in, especially in the western side of the prairies. So we have had a few snowstorms move through, and that's provided above normal precipitation for parts of those dry areas in Alberta, let's say, but it is in the form of snow. The rest of the prairies has been reasonably dry, which has helped out a bit. The forecast for the winter is basically warmer than normal temperatures.
That would be fine
for the winter. So that's, I think, good. Precipitation, they have above normal precipitation, but it's mostly weighted towards the western side of the prairies. And I would say it's probably a higher probability event in BC than it really is in, let's say, in Alberta, Saskatchewan, or right. Manitoba. So, but again, the above normal precipitation, not necessarily really what we want unless it's in some specific areas like southern Saskatchewan, southwestern Saskatchewan, and southern Alberta.
Now, we're not the only ones dealing, as far as world exporters, dealing with some inclement kind of weather conditions or climate issues. I noticed that the Australian Bureau of Research Economics had released their updated forecast, and that had some pretty stark numbers in it.
Yeah, certainly they'd been forecasting at the beginning of September a crop that was actually slightly larger than last year, and now we're seeing a cut of about 20%, so
wow,
just a bit over 15 million tons. And our markets farm number is about 14.5 million tons on the wheat side. But there's two important things going on here. This is about the third year of drought in Australia, but those droughts have been centered in the eastern growing areas. So Western Australia has actually escaped the past few years, and Western Australia really does export a significant amount of the Australian crops. So they did see exports at a fairly high level considering what kind of production they had. This year, the drought has also hit Western Australia. So production in Western Australia, ABARA estimates 6 million tons. It's probably closer to 5 million tons. So they're going to have a minimal amount of crop to export from Western Australia. So the impact on Australian exports is going to be disproportionate compared to this drop in production. So it's a really tough situation down there. It is beneficial, though, for Canada. Because they grow, if you look at the Australian crop reports, it contains the same crops that we do, and they export it into the Southeast Asian basin. So that's where our markets are too. So I think this year we're going to see strong demand from those markets because of the fact that the Australians have no longer, are not going to be able to participate this year.
So if you do happen to have some good quality cereals in the bin, and I suspect canola as well, that this might be a bright spot on the horizon.
Yes, that's right. Certainly export competition in those markets from Australia is going to be minimal. So if you look at it, it is an opportunity for us on the wheat, the canola, the barley, all the pulse crops too as well this year, because it looks like we're going to be one of the few games in town to provide product for customers in that region.
Well, let's end on a high note. Thanks for coming in, Bruce.
Thanks.
That was Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Weather and Markets Information. That's all we have for you on this week's Between the Rows, but we'll be back again next week. I hope you will be too. I'm Laura Rantz.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.